Children are a blessing from God, but when parents reject and ignore His wisdom and teaching about parenting, children can grow up to be a curse to their parents and to the world around them. What does the Bible say about parents and children, education, and child discipline? Pastor Bob Enyart covers this powerful and critical topic in his teaching series, Raising Godly Children. Order by calling 800-8-ENYART or online at kgovstore.com.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. So the big story, we're going to talk about the big story in the news today. But first, yesterday, Randall Terry held a press conference at the Democratic headquarters in Denver. He's running as a Democrat in Colorado's primary, our caucus actually, against Barack Obama. And he's doing that in order to raise money to air TV commercials showing what it means to kill a child during the Super Bowl in Colorado and in other cities around the country, other states. The video of his press conference, which was attended by Channel 7 News, and there were other reporters there. That video, you can see it online at kgov.com. Just go to, when was it? Monday's show summary, Randall Terry in the Democratic Party, and you could see that whole press conference. All right. The big story out today, and we're going to analyze this from a biblical perspective. And would these things happen? What would happen if we honored God through our public policy? Now, there are many Christians who take the position that when it comes to public policy, you don't have to worry about honoring God. That public policy is an area of human endeavor in which the Bible says that nobody has to honor God. Now, I don't quite understand that, but a lot of Christians think that when it comes to running a city, a county, a state, a nation, that Christians should advocate an amoral, godless standard. And that if you somehow say that the mayor should honor God and do what is right, somehow you're not spiritual. You're political. So plumbers should plumb in a godly way, but governors should govern in an ungodly way. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, here's the story. You're thinking we should... Well, why would that be? You're thinking we should be talking about the State of the Union address by Barack Obama? You think that's bigger than this story right here? I don't know. I think Stephen Slevin's story is bigger than Barack Obama's story. Because Barack Obama's story tells us nothing new whatsoever. His State of the Union address? Who here was hanging on every word of Barack Obama's State of the Union address? Who cared? I mean, it's eye-roll radio. We know that he's a creep, and he will govern as a creep. He's a child-killing, pro-sodomite socialist. So what's new? He thinks we evolved from animals, and then when young people behave like animals, he said, now, why would they do that? Well, let's go to this story. This is the big story, and this is from NBC, and it's a man who was held in a prison in Mexico. In Mexico, for 2 years because of a DUI arrest, and he was just awarded $22 million. And I only joked when I said it was in Mexico. It was in New Mexico. It was here in this country. He was held for 2 years in solitary confinement with no trial, no judge, no doctor. And that's one of the problems when we incarcerate people for long periods of time. Then you have to be their nanny, their teacher, their nanny, their health care provider. You got to feed them, clothe them, educate them, medicate them, entertain them. You got to do all these things. So he ended up with a toothache, and it got so bad, he had to pull his own tooth. So here's the story. Man held in solitary confinement 2 years after DWI, driving while intoxicated, which you can get from marijuana, alcohol, whatever. He was awarded $22 million. His name is Stephen Slevin, S-L-E-V-I-N. And he was in a New Mexico prison, New Mexico. Now, I know if there are public school teachers tuning in right now, you think that New Mexico is a foreign country. I know that. I know that our public school stopped teaching geography about 40 years ago, and there are plenty of kids who graduate from high school that don't know where the Atlantic Ocean is. I know that. I know that when the Olympics were in Atlanta, Georgia, that people who lived in New Mexico who called to purchase tickets were told that they had to speak to someone at their American consulate if they were from New Mexico. They were told by the Olympics, by Americans selling tickets in Atlanta, that if you want to buy tickets from a foreign country, you have to go through your local consulate. And they said, no, you don't get it. We don't live in Mexico. We live in New Mexico. And they were told, well, foreigners have to buy tickets from their local embassies. Literally, some people from New Mexico, like Santa Fe, they couldn't get tickets. They recorded it, the ordeal. But anyway, this guy spent 2 years in solitary confinement after getting arrested for a DWI. And so he's been awarded $22 million. I tell you, that's good money. If you can get a job like that, that's pretty good. Who here wouldn't give up a tooth in 2 years for a $22 million paycheck? All right, Al Sharon said he wants to keep his teeth. I'd do it. I've spent 6 months so far in jail. What's another 18 months? I could do it standing on my head. Alaska also, by the way, is considered a foreign country by some of our public school students. And if you would have watched the State of the Union address last night, you would have noticed that there's a government official who thinks there are 57 states. So there is a crisis in our education. Of course, there is, of course. But now this guy, he got $22 million after spending 2 years in New Mexico's Dona Ana County Jail. So New Mexico, they've got a Dona Ana County. And in the Dona Ana County, they got a jail. Now, he was arrested back in August of 2005 for driving while intoxicated. He never got a trial. Now, that's not especially surprising. When a country processes millions of criminals, you have paperwork mistakes. Of course you do. And things go wrong. When you have thousands and tens of thousands of murders to deal with, we have the nation celebrating, oh, our murder rate, look how low our murder rate is. You have an epidemic of murder, and people get excited because it's lower than it was a couple years ago. Sometimes it's the same effect that you have in some horror movies. Sometimes in a horror movie, everyone who can be killed is killed. It's the Alfred Hitchcock syndrome. He came on the screen at the end of one of his TV programs, and he said, I regret to inform the audience we have to end the program because all of our characters are dead. So there are only a certain amount of people that criminals want to kill. And when they kill those people, and when you've got so many criminals, millions of them in jail, then there's a lull. You haven't solved the crime epidemic. You haven't addressed the crime epidemic. So if World War II, if the primary killing was going on over a period of 4 years when there was most of the loss of life for 4 years, and if there's a lull after 1 year and 8 months, does that mean the war is ending? It doesn't mean the war is ending. It's just the natural ebb and flow of the slaughter. So when there's an ebb and flow to the bloodshed in America, Does that mean we're winning the war on crime? No, it doesn't mean that at all. So when you have tens of thousands of people murdered, without counting all the children who are dismembered by Planned Parenthood, then you have a murder epidemic. And of course, you're going to accidentally convict an innocent person. Of course you are, right? And you're going to acquit a never-ending parade of guilty murderers. Of course you are. In this guy's case, Stephen Slevin, he's not a murderer, but he committed a terrible crime. He was driving while intoxicated. And so he was arrested, and for whatever reason, he never had a trial. He didn't get to see a judge. He didn't have any health care even given. And so he finally got his day in court, and after pulling out his own tooth in a solitary confinement cell in a county jail in New Mexico, he was awarded $22 million. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about criminal justice if we did it a biblical way, biblically. Does the Bible say that if somebody commits a certain kind of a crime, the punishment is he has to go to jail for 6 months or 4 years or 20 years? Is that a punishment according to God's word? Now, I know there are a lot of Christians who are very spiritually mature, and they've concluded that when it comes to public policy, you could ignore anything God has to say, just ignore it, because God's opinion is irrelevant. Somehow they tend to think their own opinion is significant, but God's opinion is irrelevant. And if, in fact, God has some thoughts on criminal justice that are foolish or passé or irrelevant, no longer applicable, well, then identify them and explain why they're not valid. But don't just ignore the Lord. Don't just ignore the scriptures as though it doesn't matter what God has said and what fills the world's number one bestseller, God's word. The books that Jesus Christ quoted most frequently, let's not pretend that it didn't matter to him, and so it shouldn't matter to us what's in those books. So in the Bible, does the Bible say that governments should incarcerate people as a form of punishment? There was a lot of incarceration going on during the Bible events. Remember the Egyptians? Remember they threw Joseph in jail, the Egyptians? They had a prison. There's the baker and the cupbearer, all kinds of people in jail. And remember the Canaanites? They had prison. You could check Numbers chapter 21. The Philistines, I went through the Bible. I did a seminar on this topic a few years ago called God's Criminal Justice System. So I went through the Bible and I marked all the passages where there is a reference to people being incarcerated, being in prison. And what I found out was that all the governments who put people in jail as a form of punishment, they were all evil governments, wicked governments, and that God never commanded anyone to imprison a criminal as a form of punishment. There are three places in the Bible where God says that you should imprison a criminal. In Exodus 22, in Leviticus 24, and Numbers 15. In all three of those places, you incarcerate the suspect while the trial is underway. If it's shoplifting and it's going to take 3 or 4 days to get the witnesses together, you don't necessarily have to incarcerate the suspect. But if it's a severe crime where the punishment is such that the suspect may flee, well, then you incarcerate the suspect, like for a kidnapping or a serious assault, or of course, a murder. Then you incarcerate the suspect, you hold him in custody until there is a verdict, guilty or not guilty, and then the sentence is executed. So that's it. That's how long you hold the suspect in custody, until he's no longer a suspect, until he's either acquitted or convicted. And you know what doesn't happen if you follow the biblical model you don't end up having to take care of criminals for years or decades and feed them and clothe them and educate them and medicate them, keep them warm in winter, cool in summer, so that they believe themselves they're living a life of leisure. Do you think inmates believe they're living a life of leisure? Well, let me give you one example. Let's see. How far back in the archives do I have to go to pull this one up? This is from ABC News, North Carolina, January 25th, 2012. It's from today. It's from today, all right? A North Carolina death row inmate writes a letter to the local newspaper about his life of leisure. And this is the story. A convicted murderer on death row in North Carolina, we've been talking about this kind of thing for 20 years on the air, wrote a taunting letter to his hometown newspaper about his life of leisure in prison. And he's making a mockery of the legal system. And what he's saying is true. And so we should take it into account and fix the problem. And the way you fix it is using God's wisdom. His name is Danny Robbie Hembree Jr., and he murdered a 17-year-old girl, Heather Catterton, in 2009. So he's been sentenced to death. He's on death row. He's 50 years old. Now, he's going to die of old age, right? That's the way people on death row die. The number one cause of death on death row is old age. He's in prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he sent a letter to the Gaston Gazette. And this is what he wrote. He wrote, "Is the public aware that I am a gentleman of leisure? I watch color TV and air conditioning. I read. I take naps whenever I want to. I eat three well-balanced hot meals a day. I'm housed in a building that connects to the new $55 million hospital, and I have round-the-clock free medical care, 24/7. No kidding, right? And he says, look, the chances that I'm going to be executed are very slim in the next 20 years. So the county district attorney, Locke Bell is his name, said he received a distraught phone call from Heather's dad. He said, I got a call from the father of that 17-year-old girl, Heather Catterton, that this criminal murdered. And he said that the father is just devastated by this letter. Of course, he would be. It is ripping the wound open again, the DA told ABC News. But the district attorney had enough common sense to say this. There's a part of me that wants everybody to read the letter because it tells a lot of truth about death row. It sure does. So if we followed the biblical prescription for running a criminal justice system, the number of victims would plummet and we would not turn thousands of our own kids into murderers. So in the Bible, the Egyptians, all these evil governments, they used incarceration as punishment, not just to hold someone during a trial. And by the way, trials should be speedy. A speedy trial, right, is fundamental to justice. And if you're arrested on a DUI, if you're arrested on a DUI charge, and they keep you in jail for 2 years or 20 years, then could that possibly be justice? No, it cannot be justice. That can't be justice. So speedy trial right. In your county courts, the speedy trial is your right. That's how our system is designed. In federal court, the speedy trial right is the government's right. Did you know that? So then you want to find out, does the government want to waive its speedy trial right if you're in federal court? In county court, the way our laws are set up, it's your right. Well, there is a right to a speedy trial. And so, and by the way, a speedy trial should be within hours and days after the crime, typically, not months and years. That's an absurdity. And that's a symptom of our system of justice, which it's no longer a justice system. Now it's just a system. And the longer a trial takes, the more money the lawyers make on both sides, and the more money the judge and all the whole apparatchik makes. So that's just, it's the way it works. It's job security. So for trials to last months or years, it's no skin off the judge's back. or the attorney's back. Typically, they just make more and more money. So the whole system is broken. But the Assyrians had prisons, and the Babylonians, and the Persians. And there were also wicked Jewish kings who would imprison people, like Ahab and Asa and Zedekiah. In our God's Criminal Justice seminar, we give all the specifics, all the Bible verses, and you could look these things up for yourself. You could see that wicked nations and wicked kings imprison people as a form of punishment. So did a false prophet in the book of Jeremiah. Shemaiah was a false prophet who imprisoned someone as a punishment. And of course, the Romans, right? The Romans imprisoned people as a form of punishment. And the great persecutors, King Herod, imprisoned people as a form of punishment. So did the Philippian magistrates. And so did the chief sinner, the Apostle Paul. He would seek to imprison people, namely followers of Christ. Oh, and by the way, the devil would like to imprison people. So prison is not a form of punishment that God has authorized for the use of civil governments, nor that he ever approves of. Never. Never. And if someone is in prison, then followers of Christ, we Christians, we should visit those people and minister to those people. So a prison ministry is biblical. It's very valid. In fact, I had for 6 months, I had a full-time prison ministry, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, full-time prison ministry. But prison ministries are conceptually, they're very valid. But so this guy, if we were living in a nation that honored God, including in its criminal justice system, then Stephen Slevin would have never gone through this. And it would not have cost the poor fools in Dona Ana County, the poor taxpayers, it wouldn't have cost them $22 million plus all the court costs and the overhead of him eventually getting his award, plus the money we paid to keep him in prison for 2 years. Well, in jail, typically it's a county jail, and it's a state or federal prison. So imagine how much it usually costs, many tens of thousands of dollars a year to keep somebody in jail. Many tens of thousands of dollars, and all the money spent in the courts and all the attorneys to decide, and the judges' salaries and their retirement benefits, you know, and their vacation day and their sick pay and their assistants and the clerks and all, and the Taj Mahals they usually build for these judges to go to work at a place that they, you know, can feel important at. And you have to call them Your Honor, because if they had honor, they wouldn't want to be called Your Honor. But since they don't have honor, they make sure that you call them Your Honor and all that. So it probably cost about $23 million for this guy's DUI. And that's one of the problems with our system generally. You have the victims of crime, and then not only are they the victim by the criminal who made them a victim, but then the government makes us a victim again because we have to pay outrageous costs for the conduct of the criminal trials, and then for the incarceration. So if somebody commits a heinous crime and they're in jail for 10 years or 40 years, it costs millions of dollars, millions. And the victims end up paying again. When there is a murder, let's say you have an extended family, and somebody in the family, a niece, gets murdered. Then what? And the guy ends up, after 3, 4, 5, 8 years of trials and appeals and retrials, appellate, all that, and then he ends up in total in jail for 38 years. Could you imagine the cost that all the victims And not only the extended family and all the friends, but then the community, what everybody has to pay for this criminal, you end up paying millions of dollars. The victims, the family, the friends, and the community pays millions of dollars to punish the criminal. Millions of dollars. So he got you. Whether he's acquitted or not, when he's guilty, he got you. Even when he's convicted, he got you. And the victims are paying for the rest of their lives. And altogether, we're paying billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars, with America having one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. And we have our judges. My wife, Cheryl, last time she went to jury duty was yesterday, January 24th, 2012. She went to jury duty, and, you know, the whole system is, it's just so broken and such a scam, and they manipulate you before you're even selected to be in the jury from the jury pool during what they call voir dire, which means to ask questions. They like to speak in Latin so you think that they know more than you do. And Cheryl's very bold. And the defense attorney said, now, if you, for any reason, if you convicted my client for this crime on this day, and my client is charged with the same crime on these other 2 days, could you totally separate in your mind the conviction on the one day with the charges on the other days? And Cheryl said, of course not. If we realize your client is guilty on this day, that means your client is the kind of criminal who would commit this crime. So then if there's evidence that your client committed the same crime on these other days, of course we would be more likely to agree that your client is guilty on those days also. Once Cheryl said that, then the whole jury pool was saying the same thing. And they followed, thankfully, they were thinking. And so the defense attorney, he gets some peremptory challenges. What is it, 3? He gets to kick people off for no reason. Because if they have a conscience and if they know right from wrong. So he kicked Cheryl off right off the bat. She would have loved to be on the jury, but it's hard because if you want to be on a jury, let's say it's a death penalty case, they do their best to find jurors who are utterly uninformed and apathetic. I mean, that's the primary qualification. When there's a death penalty case, they want to find people who don't know about the case. That puts you right at the top of the list. So let's say Scott Peterson murdered his wife and his child. Lacey and Connor Peterson. Remember the baby also? He was charged with murdering the baby too. So you go to court, you're called in jury duty, and you're in the jury pool. And they say, well, do you know about this case? And you say, no, I don't know anything about the case. Well, you're more qualified than anyone who's actually informed. You're ignorant. You're reasonably qualified. And then they say, well, do you have an opinion on the death penalty? Well, no, I really don't have an opinion. You're double qualified. So the most ignorant and apathetic among you go to the top of the list on the conduct of criminal justice in America. And we have what we call justice by committee. Justice by committee. Criminal justice should be the most important function of government in a nation. Criminal justice. Upholding the law. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kidnap. Thou shalt not slug someone in the mouth because you don't like them. So to try suspects to see if they're guilty or not, this is very important. Well, we delegate that responsibility to an anonymous committee. A committee that has no identity, that's put together virtually anonymously, and then disbands. And so regardless of the miscarriage of justice, even if they let murderers go free, there's no accountability. There's no accountability chain. The prosecutor says, and the judge says, the whole system says, well, it's not our fault. It was the committee. What committee? Well, they're disbanded. So something where there should be a solid accountability chain, so that if there is a miscarriage of justice, someone could be held accountable for gross negligence, like letting a murderer like O.J. Simpson go free. There's no one who's accountable. In our God's Criminal Justice seminar, which, by the way, we have as an audio download, you can get right now at kgov.com, or on DVD. You could watch it on DVD, or you could get a written syllabus from us. Just go to KGov. And why do you think it's called KGov? G-O-V? KGov, the letters of a radio station. G-O-V for government, because authority comes from God. Check it out.
The murderers on death row today should be executed. Excuse me, what did he just say? My name's Doug McBurney, and I heard Bob Enyart say just that in 1995, and I've been listening ever since. I found out that the death penalty is at the heart of the gospel, and that Christianity and justice need not be mutually exclusive. A video titled God and the Death Penalty is available today at kgov.com. God and the Death Penalty examines God's ideas about justice. You'll learn the New Testament verses affirming the death penalty and understand why God never repealed capital punishment. Find out God's opinion. Order God and the Death Penalty today at kgov.com. That's God and the Death Penalty at kgov.com.